On this episode of The Flophouse, we discuss the surprisingly long 88 minutes. Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Flophouse. I'm Dan McCoy.
I'm Elliot Kalin.
And Stuart Wellington is not here. And
Yeah,
that jerk.
No, I mean, boo, like, I wish he was here.
Sure, that as well. But unlike other times when he's absent, we don't have a special guest.
Boo!
Yeah.
We tried. Everyone was busy.
Yeah.
Apparently, people were too excited about sleeping off their hangovers from last night's election.
Yeah, we are recording this a mere day after Barack Obama was elected president of the United States. Elliot, Barack Obama appeared on The Daily Show the week before the election. So, would you like to take this opportunity to take credit for his win?
Yes.
All right.
Actually, I'd like to take credit for his win. Because of the fist bump that I shared with him about a year ago, I guess.
Right.
When he was a guest via satellite last week, but he was a guest in person quite some time ago. And due to a mishap involving a bag of Doritos that I won't get into here, we were unable to shake hands, and so we fist bumped instead.
Right.
And I think I think you taught him the fist bump. That, and I think just I gave him the power to win presidential elections through my fist.
Or through the Doritos dust that was on your hand.
Maybe it was
radioactive Doritos dust.
The Doritos dust that made it impossible for me to shake his hand because I had not washed my hands since I had eaten a bag of Doritos.
Yeah.
I must have looked like the biggest slob in the world because I was literally standing at the end of a line of people waiting to shake his hand, and I'm just sitting there stuffing Doritos into my face as he makes his way down the line.
Yeah.
It was just like the Mr. Bean when the queen mother is going to the movie theater that he works at, and he's literally like trying to fix his fly while she slowly works her way down the line. So I like finished the Doritos, and I was like, oh no, I got Dorito dust all over my hands, looking around for napkins, and didn't, you know.
That makes it so much worse, because before I had pictured the story like, you know, you're in the editing bay or something. You're eating Doritos.
He stops
you. You wander. You exit the room, and people are leading him out, and they're like, "Oh, Elliot, you know, say hello to Senator Obama." And
nope.
You're like, "Oh." And
I knew very well that I was going to be shaking his hand.
You had
still
plenty of time to rectify the situation.
Couldn't
maybe dust it off on your pants.
Couldn't resist the siren song of Doritos, and then I didn't have enough time to clean my hands thoroughly.
But now the thing is, like, this improves your anecdote tremendously. You're going to be telling your grandchildren, "Yes, the first black president, I was unable to shake his hand
because of the Doritos.
Due to my love of Doritos." In fact, you should probably get an endorsement deal from Doritos.
I wish that Doritos had a series of commercials called Doritos Stories. And I could tell that one. And they'd pay me in Doritos. The same way I've actually fantasized recently about someday, if I am famous, doing ads for Popeye's Fried Chicken because I love their product so much.
It's
and
true.
Just
he
doing
does.
Ads for, like, "Hey, I'm Elliot Kalin. Oh, this is great chicken." And I'm saying that because I really believe in it.
Well, I think I want to tell all the audience members
and
out
I
there.
And I feel like I would ask for a deal where I could walk into any Popeye's and eat for free whenever I wanted.
Yeah. Well,
anyway,
I think the only reason that Elliot continues to do the show as he rockets to success is that I live mere blocks away from a Popeyes, and every time before the movie he comes in with a box of Popeyes. So Doritos and Popeyes, both of you, if you're listening, we are not too proud to take your sponsorship
money.
Don't
give up on this endorsement opportunity.
Yeah. So
we're listened to by fives of people.
I think it's in part Stuart's absence, in part the film that we watched. I feel like we're having a little effort.
We're a little dragged down, yeah.
Yes,
Stuart definitely would have helped because he's full of energy and hilarious sayings, and also, like, he'd probably do something crazy or silly, you know, or say something filthy.
Yeah. He'd probably do a dance. He'd probably do the real Ghostbusters dance.
He'd be like, "Hey, dudes, well, this movie wasn't so good, was it?" You know, and so forth. He modulates his voice a lot when he talks.
Yeah, but much lower than that.
Yeah, well, listen.
Yours is like a really foppish, like, "So, dudes, 88 minutes. 88 minutes is the most awesome movie ever."
Was it just me, or did that movie suck? You know,
yeah.
Yeah, my impression of him is not very good.
More of like a Paul Lynde sort of Stewart.
No, that doesn't sound anything like Paul Lynde. But yeah, Stewart's not here to end. And the movie itself was, this is a movie we were both very excited to do on the show, 88 Minutes, yeah. Starring Al Pacino.
For God's sakes, why?
I think there was something about the fact that it stars Al Pacino, a once great actor who has let himself fall apart. In terms of, not even in terms of, like, his life is fine, but in terms of not caring anymore.
Well, I mean, we don't know.
Yeah, that's true. But it's not like, you know, William Holden or Marlon Brando or something. Like, right. Like an actor who had serious emotional or, you know, addictive problems, and his life kind of fell apart a little bit.
Or Michael Moriarty, who moved to Canada and opened up a piano bar.
Yeah, exactly. I guess. But this is Al Pacino, who still is incredibly well-respected, could do any movie he wanted. He's a man who, or at one point, now I feel like he can no longer open a movie and guarantee success. And also the movie had the gimmick that part of it at least was supposed to be told in real time. Al Pacino's character only is called by a serial killer and told he only has 88 minutes to live. And then in theory it's real time from that point
on. Well,
and also there was the semen transference note, but that wasn't a big major plot point. We'll get to that part.
Let's make it clear, though, for viewers who may be interested in watching this film. Say that you have 88 minutes before your tickets to Mamma Mia on Broadway.
You're taking your lady friend to a show, and she's like, "Oh, I'll be ready in just a minute," and you know that means 88 minutes.
Yeah, personal experience, you know that she takes exactly 88 minutes
exactly
to pretty herself up, and you're like, "Oh, I can pop in 88 minutes starring Al Pacino."
No, you can't.
Yeah, put in one of the old Universal horror movies; they're all around 80 minutes.
Read a book. You know, do something else.
This film is actually an hour and 40 minutes long.
I have to say
that.
And long at that. If it was 88 minutes long, it would have been a better movie, but nowhere. It would have been about as incoherent as it is right now.
And let's also make it clear that this is no High Noon. This is also no Nick of Time starring Johnny Depp.
Or Snake Eyes.
Yeah, the real time component of it is massaged.
It's the kind of movie where it's supposed to the killer says, like, "You have 65 minutes to live," and then Al Pacino gets in a cab and says, "I got to drive across town." You cut to him on the other side of town, and then the guy, and it'll be 5 minutes later in screen time, and the killer goes, "You have 60 minutes to live." It's like, wow, he got across Seattle in record time. Well, I don't know how big Seattle is, but I assume it takes more than a cut worth of time, like 20 seconds, 5 seconds. You know, Dan, are you all right? You look like 88 minutes really took you down a couple notches.
It really did.
Maybe we should just pop in the Bratz movie and enjoy ourselves. Would you like me to go to explain the plot of the film, Dan?
Yeah, go through it. Why don't you?
Al Pacino is famous forensic psychologist Jack Graham, who's a college professor and is, as I mentioned, a famous forensic psychologist professor. So we're in a fantasy world already. Who is most famous for putting away a man named John Forster on death row, who supposedly hangs women from pulley systems and then kills them and tortures them. But, like, there's only circumstantial evidence plus the word of the famous Jack Graham to put him away. So there's questions about maybe this guy was actually innocent. He's about to be – it's the day of his execution. He's scheduled to be executed. And MSNBC is running a, what, four-hour-long live interview?
I don't know. It's a live broadcast.
This is a movie where – here's if I – and maybe I missed something, but it seems that Al Pacino goes to his apartment, goes through his TiVo listings, chooses the interview on MSNBC, presses play, and then a little later calls into the interview as if it's still going – this is that – like it's as if time stopped and doesn't restart again until he selects it on his TiVo and he can call in. But anyway, it's the day of the execution and people who are close to Al Pacino start dying and – he gets a phone call, a mysterious phone call in that stupid serial killer fake voice that everything uses now. "You have 88 minutes to live. Tick-tock, doc.
Tick-tock, doc.
You have 88 minutes to live, blah, blah, blah." And then, so he suspects everybody. He's a college professor now, so he walks into his class and immediately starts berating the students, assuming that one of them is the killer. And it goes on from there and makes less and less sense as it goes on.
One thing that really sort of bugged me about this film was the fact that Al Pacino immediately takes this call at face value. There's no beat where he's like, "What? That's weird. Well, probably a crank call." And then something
happens.
I am
a famous forensic psychologist, Dr. Jack Graham.
Yeah, no, instead he immediately walks into class and starts like looking, like searching the students' faces and like ripping cell phones from their hands.
He does everything short of hold a newspaper in front of his face with eye holes cut out and just watch people through it.
And I sort of also wonder, you know, if that's true, why is he still teaching his class if he's going to take it at face value? And this is what I was trying to remember before, is that this movie is real time in so much as they show a lot of unnecessary in-between steps. Like, once the 88 minutes starts, it's like, well, we're going to follow him as he goes through every component of his day. Now he's teaching his class. Now he's driving back. Now he and his TA are going back home.
He and his TA, played by Alicia Witt, spend a lot of time...
lovely Alicia Witt.
Spend a lot of time hanging out in his apartment. And it reminded me of Ringu, the original Japanese version of the... Or I guess the feature film Japanese version of The Ring. Not the... I guess there had been like a direct-to-video version before that, and this was a remake of it. But anyway, the one that was remade in the United States, where they get the phone... They watch the video, they get the phone call that says, you have 7 days to live. And they're like, oh my God! Oh, well, I guess I'll start figuring this out tomorrow.
Or like, 7 days. Well, I should rest up.
Yeah, later in the movie, it's like, well, we've got 2 days left to live. Let's go down to the library and research this. And it's like, 6 o'clock, library's closing. Let's call it a day. All right.
Thank God, Elliot. They can't do the world in 7 days.
No, but they
take it a little slow.
There's, let's say, a lack of intensity. Or lack of believable anxiety.
If Al Pacino is to believe that, if he thinks that someone's killing him, that's when the movie should kick into drive. Let's take this out on the road.
But instead it kind of ambles around for a while. It kicks into drive pretty quickly, and then it has a very long, flabby section in the middle, and then his car blows up, and suddenly things get kicked into crazy overdrive where nothing makes sense.
It makes sense to the degree that I have a hard time sort of picking out what I want to talk about.
Well, it's the fact that the killer, who is a human being without magical powers, seems to be in several places at once all the time.
Yeah,
like
that's
true. They're just ahead of Al Pacino. They're breaking into Al Pacino's apartment. They're also across town killing someone. They're setting up an elaborate pulley system in a public building that no one sees, and then arranging for someone else to make a phone call. And it's just, it doesn't...
Yeah, well, all right.
It's like there's an army of killers, and there's this... there's a ridiculous red herring that goes on forever with Alicia Witt's ex-husband, Guy LaForge. Which is a hilarious name.
The famous French-Canadian trapper, Guy LaForge.
But it's also like they're being chased by a man in – or by some figure in black leather outfit who's wearing a motorcycle helmet. And she goes, oh, that's Guy. It has to be. Really? Okay. I guess no one else has ever dressed like that.
Yeah.
This is the only guy in Seattle who dresses like that.
She's never seen a motorcyclist before. That's what you got to realize is in Seattle, you know, there's only two motorcyclists. Yeah, one thing about the whole being everywhere thing is the whole setup of this movie requires like the guy to continually be making phone calls to Al Pacino, being like 88 minutes, 79 minutes, 76 minutes, 69 minutes. And, you know, Al Pacino will get messages like scrawled on his overhead projector at class, or then like keyed into his car's paint job. And you have to wonder, like, how does the murderer know that Al Pacino is going to go down and get into his car
at the exact
72-minute mark?
Because he took a different route to get to the parking garage, and he looks and he goes, 72 minutes. According to my watch, I've only got 68 minutes. This is great. I got some time back. And the killer is like watching from afar and slaps her forehead and goes, no, he's not getting the message properly. Ah, yeah. I gave away that the killer was a woman.
Yeah, well, I was about to give it away because there's a scene where Lily Sobieski, right before that actually, or right after, in the parking garage, gets beat up. And later on, it's revealed that she's beat herself up to throw suspicion off of herself that was not there in the first place. And Al Pacino, you know, she's like, oh, I can't believe I let the killer get away.
That was so stupid of me.
And Al Pacino goes, don't beat yourself up. And then he says it again.
As if, in case you didn't catch it the first time.
Foreshadowing.
Don't beat yourself up about it.
This movie is nothing if not thorough in reiterating things. There's several lines of dialogue that just basically repeat the same thing over and over in different permutations of the sentence
You
structure.
Also see multiple... You see the same flashback of a celebration at a bar over and over again,
right,
with no new information being added every time. And at the end, it's one of those movies where there's a showdown between the hero and the villain in which it's made pretty clear what's going on. And then the hero has a phone call with somebody else in which he goes over what the plot of the movie was.
Audience, we know that this movie was pretty crazy and unbelievable.
You're probably having a hard time keeping track. So, this is kind of like Schenectady, New York. It's kind of hard to keep track of the first time you watch it.
Yeah.
So let's explain it.
I was watching it and I'm like, all right, movie. Yes, this movie was crazy and it had a lot of twists, but that doesn't mean I didn't understand it. It just means it was dumb. It just means it didn't
make
any sense.
It doesn't make any sense. Yeah, there's no sense to it. And even for like a fun, stupid movie, it's not fun. It's just stupid. It just doesn't make – enough sense that you're intrigued and want to know what's going on. And the whole thing is so – like there's this very seedy undercurrent to it. There's a lot of women's bodies hanging from ceilings.
Yeah, well, like the first nude woman we see in the film is doing like this crazy –
She's standing up nude, brushing her teeth with holding one leg up in the air.
Yeah.
Standing on one leg. And
I'm willing to believe there are women out there who would do that except for the teeth brushing. Like
it's
maybe
if
they're stretching
toothbrush.
In the morning, like, you know, like, I'm naked. I'm doing a little yoga. I'm really like, you know, I'm just going to air everything out and now, but also to brush your teeth. That's multitasking gone amok.
But even that, like, there's a part where it's revealed that Al Pacino's assistant, this woman, it was me. I accidentally helped the killer because I got drunk and she seduced me and we made out in your office. And it was like, wait a minute. I didn't even know this character was a lesbian. It comes out of nowhere. And it's one of those things where it's like, that's kind of seedy, but also like, how was I supposed to put two and two together on that one when I didn't even know that these characters knew each other?
The movie was like, we haven't had a close up on a woman's panty clad ass as she hangs from the ceiling for a while. Let's have some casual, pointless lesbianism thrown in. Yeah, but also like,
but also like, it's a movie where you can tell Lily Sobieski is the villain at the end because her hair is much more wild and disheveled than it was earlier in the film.
I guess they did.
That's good directing.
They did foreshadow that Lily Sobieski was a lesbian because, as you pointed out, she was dressed like Annie Hall in The Class.
I hadn't even thought of that. That's right. Yeah, she's wearing a tie and a vest
and
a shirt, which of course means if this is 1952, she must be a lesbian.
Except for she was also in love with the killer on death row. So.
That's true. I guess she was just playing lesbianism to get to the information she needed. It's never quite clear if she's in love with the killer on death row or if she's just enthralled to him in some way. It's a movie that if they established at the beginning of the movie that mind control and hypnotism existed in the world of 88 Minutes, the movie would make a lot more sense and would be much easier to take.
But this movie, oh man, a lot of style, huh? Stylistic flourishes.
It's a movie that has a lot of cracks in the foundation of the story, and they said, let's plaster over this with a lot of unnecessary camera moves.
A lot of zooming in. A lot of slow-mo.
The best thing is that Al Pacino remembers his backstory is that his young sister, when he was 28 and she was 12, which is quite a gap in ages, his young sister was murdered, so now he's trying to get revenge, I guess, against the idea of murder. But
was so angry at that like long monologue because no one in movies goes into a field just because they were interested in it or they had a talent for it.
No, they need an inciting incident.
It's all based in a childhood trauma. And yeah, Al Pacino's young sister was killed by a serial killer. So now he hunts serial killers.
But when he remembers her, his memories are shown as if, I guess, they're like 16mm film from the 70s. There's a lot of like scratches and a kind of general yellowish color filter, but it's as Al Pacino's so old that he's remembering in a film stock that is no longer used.
Yeah, well, you know, back in that time, 8mm film was how people made memories.
It didn't help that they showed a picture that's supposed to be him with his sister when he was young, and it's like they used a picture of young Al Pacino, and it's like, oh, that's what he looked like when he made good movies.
Yeah.
That's what he looked like when he made Serpico and Dog Day Afternoon. Oh, sorry. Oh, and also he likes driving his own car for some reason. His car gets blown up and he goes up to a cab driver and he goes, listen, I want to drive your cab across town. I'll give you $100. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of the movie is him driving this cab around while the cab driver sits in the back seat.
Yeah, and you wonder why, you know, if he's gonna rent the cab, he can just pay the cab driver. Like, why does he need to be in charge? It's not like he's even driving like super fast.
No,
like the cab driver's
no stunts.
Like, I'm not gonna break the law. I'm like, fine, I'll rent the cab. You get in the back. And no, he's just like driving sensibly around town. And more than that, there's a scene towards the end. My wife pointed out, there's a scene where he's sitting at a red light, and it turns green, and all the cars go around him because he's transfixed. He's putting the pieces together. He's looking at a file. He's making some sort of revelation that I actually could not follow what he was putting.
Something about someone together. Using an alias for something.
Yeah, but there's clearly just him alone in the car. And then
there's no one in the backseat.
He drives to the rendezvous with the killer, and he runs out, and the cab driver gets out of the back, being like, "Hey, is it all done yet? do you need me anymore?" And you're like, "What? Well, was he taking a nap in the back? Was
apparently
he in the trunk?
Sleeping in the backseat?" I've always wondered what it'd be like to drive around in the trunk of this thing.
As long as you're gonna take over, heck, seems like a good time.
There's another character in it who is Al Pacino's, I guess, police contact, mm-hmm. who. Is it's one of those things where it's like, I'm gonna have to arrest you. Your fingerprints and DNA are all over the bodies. You've got access and motive. You know everyone who was killed. We found your belongings on the scene of the crime and your signature. Wait, no.
And your semen was in her vaginal canal, as
you
said.
And your semen was in her vaginal canal. And Al Pacino goes, "Don't you see it's a frame up? Give me 10 minutes." And the guy goes, "Okay."
It's elementary police work. Come on. Classic frame.
They
job.
teach us at the academy, if it looks like an airtight case, there's probably a problem with it. So yeah. Give the guy extra time. And it also, it's implied, I guess, that Al Pacino was set up to have sex with a woman, then they killed her, removed his semen from her body, and injected it into another dead body to implicate him in that murder, too.
Yeah, two and murders. He's like two murders for the price of one semen.
This is something that's brought up almost casually in conversation and then dropped. And it's such a horrific idea. I'm like, there's something so disgusting about it. And it's like, no, let's just throw it in the script.
Well,
whatever.
And again, that was also a development that happens like at the hour 20 minute mark. Likewise,
the audience is getting tired. We got to wake them up, put some semen in there.
Well, but he doesn't even get accused of like these murders until like the hour mark. And I'm like, shouldn't this have happened way earlier in the film to add a little more urgency? I mean, I know that he's going to be killed in 88 minutes, apparently, and that should add enough urgency, but not the way he's wandering around. Apparently, we need another shot.
That's the other thing. I bet, like, the killer stops calling him after a while. It's almost like the movie forgets about the 88 minutes thing until later on. And then it just turns out that the killer arranges a rendezvous with Al Pacino and then waits for the countdown to get to zero and then is just going to shoot him. It's not like he's been injected with a poison that goes on off
DOA.
In 88 minutes. There's no bomb set to go off in 88 minutes.
It's not, as you pointed out, Crank. He hasn't been given the Hong Kong cocktail and his heart's going to explode or whatever.
There's really no reason for the 88-minute deadline to be there.
Yeah, as you pointed out, like her plan would have gone a lot easier if she just warned him at the top, like, you got 88 minutes to live, left him alone, and then an 88-minute mark came up and shot him.
Or even,
the
like,
end.
What she really wants is a confession from him that he committed perjury and that the guy in death row is probably innocent. But she accomplishes this through a series of mysterious murders and crazy clues. And, like, her plan would have been that much harder for him to figure out and that much easier for her to get the information if she didn't go around murdering random people that he knew and then placing his DNA all over. It's like, she's like, I'll get him arrested, thrown in jail, and then I'll have access to him to get this taped confession.
Well,
no,
right.
That's not really how it works.
Yeah, I guess that she was like, okay, I can't just go up to him and threaten him to get this tape confession, because then clearly
I better spin a web of deceit.
Yeah. But then she's like, I gotta discredit him, implicate him as a murderer, then kill him. I don't know. Like, it seems like
it's not a well thought out.
You discredited him as a is his confession worth anything? Like, I don't know. It's not a mastermind plan.
I wish Stuart was here to answer these thorny legal problems.
Yeah, I was talking about how things are reiterated too much in this film. Like, things happen twice when they could have happened once. That's another issue I have with the climax of the film. Not once, but twice does Lili Sobieski have one of the red herring characters in the film call Al Pacino and confess that she's the person behind everything. He has Deborah Kara Unger's character, who's like the dean of the school or something.
She's some kind of dean who's always wearing glasses that are way down on her nose.
Yeah.
But it's also like this is some school in Seattle that with no ethical standards, because like Al Pacino and his law students or criminal investigation students, whatever they're doing, they go to a bar to celebrate the fact that he led to a man's conviction. But the dean is also there, and the professor and students are all drinking together and dancing, and then he goes home with one of them. And the dean is there, like, watching this. I don't know. And she seems to have some sort of romantic anger over the whole thing. Like, it seems like a very unprofessional school, I guess is what I'm saying. If you want to take Jack Graham's class, just know he will come on to you.
And he will grab your chest as he throws you to the ground to avoid a bomb going off in the car, as he does with Alicia Witt.
Al Pacino was very clearly groping Alicia Witt at one point, it seems.
But it bothered me, though. Like, Deborah Kara Unger's character, the killer, had call in with a false confession. And then she also had Alicia Witt call in with a false confession, both of them to lure Al Pacino to the rendezvous point. I'm like, wouldn't one have sufficed?
Or even just the killer saying, Dr. Jack Graham, meet me at such and such place. You've got 10 minutes to live. Tick tock. Because he wants to know who it is. Like, he'll just go there.
I will reveal myself to you. Finally, this game of cat and mouse will end.
This game of cat calls mouse and mouse runs around for a while and then goes to his apartment and sits down for a little bit and watches TV.
Yeah. Calls in to MSNBC to rant angrily.
They put up the picture on the screen that says Dr. Jack Graham, and as you said, it looks like they caught him coming out of a club in the middle of the night.
Yeah, it's like a perp photo of early Sean Penn.
The idea of a famous forensic psychologist, I guess, is one of the things that gets me. It's the same way that...
It's like Roadhouse.
Well, that's the thing, yeah.
Famous bouncer.
Where, I think Mike Nelson writes a thing about that. Like, the idea of a famous bouncer doesn't make any sense in Roadhouse. And the same thing here, like, even the guy who wrote, like, Mindhunter and, like, Silence of the Lambs was partly based on his experiences, whose name I don't remember at the moment. Like, even he is not so famous that everybody knows his name, or that if he called into a TV show, they'd be like, oh, of course, well, yes, the famous, oh, yeah, oh, you're known everywhere, this is, oh, well, of course, Dr. Jack Graham, oh, well, come right this way, sir. He's like, I don't know, like the way Henry Kissinger was a famous club goer and dated lots of movie stars when he was Secretary of State, like that, but he's a forensic psychologist.
Yeah, with no actual power out in the world like Henry Kissinger.
He does have a badge that I guess says that he...
Power is the ultimate aphrodisiac.
That Dr. Kissinger stopped by for just a moment.
I've got to go. I enjoyed watching 88 Minutes with you.
I think... do you think, Dan, it would have been easier to watch 88 Minutes if we didn't know that this is a new world with Barack Obama as president and we won't have to worry about movies like this anymore? I feel like this is part of the change that we can believe in, is that 88 Minutes, there's not going to be nothing like this again.
Yeah. Well, for me, it was like, okay, Barack Obama's won. Yay. Hooray. Everything's wonderful. And then, like, I'm like, oh, no, I have to return to my normal life, which includes watching movies like 88 Minutes on purpose.
I got to tell you, I was
a voluntary podcast. I want to make that clear.
I was so excited about 88 Minutes and being as depressed about it as I am now. It makes me double think my excitement about our eventual watching of Mr. Megorium's Wonder Emporium, which is another one I've been very excited about.
Yeah. That's slated for December.
I'm really worried that there's going to be a scene where Natalie Portman confronts Dustin Hoffman about how his semen was found in a dead body in the back closet of their magical toy shop.
I wanted to say just one last thing about this film, and that was, man, so many red herrings.
It is full of red herrings.
Full of red herring characters, including campus security guy named, like, something DeFranco, I remember. I don't remember.
And also a doorman who's just kind of goofy, who looks like he wandered in off the set of Newhart.
But the campus security is like, it's like CTU on 24. Like, it's the most...
There's screens everywhere. Lots of, like, plexiglass, smoked glass partitions. But also, he's talking to the security guard, and the security guard's like, because they're setting him up as a red herring. He's like, yeah, I'm going to go to the police academy, become a real cop, not have to take care of these snotty college kids, especially these rich bitches. And he's like, and Pacino's like, yep, gotta go, and walks out and calls the police and asks them to look at this guy. But he's like, what kind of, again, the security guard has so much rage about the people, the women that he has to protect.
I appreciate the efficiency of that, though. Like, just like, within... two sentences, he says something potentially incriminating. Like, the anger comes floating to the but surface.
Even, like, the suspicious doorman. They go to Al Pacino's building. He's like, where's so-and-so? His doorman's like, ah, he's not here. I'm a temp. There was a guy came by looking for you. Dropped off a package. It's right here. Didn't leave his name, though. There's no return address on this. Yeah, I don't know. Like, why even bother with all the side? I'm surprised they didn't make the cab driver a suspicious character. I'm surprised they didn't have, like, his mailman come by and drop stuff off. Fresh Direct.
Delivering the mail.
I don't remember ordering all this Fresh Direct. Ah, your name's right here on the order form. You don't want these kiwis?
Here's a suspiciously large eggplant. I don't know what's in the eggplant in the scenario. But...
I can't wait to find out, though, in 88 minutes, too. 176 minutes.
The eggplant protocol.
Oh, I forgot how Al Pacino, as you mentioned while we were watching it, Al Pacino's performance is fairly, he's not overdoing it the way he does in, say, The Devil's Advocate.
There's no hoo-hawing.
He does have some yelling scenes, but they're not, it's like he's getting angry, so it makes sense. But at the end of the movie, there's like a flash of the Al Pacino we've come to know and love, where he's taunting the real killer on the phone, and he says to him, like, your plan failed, and now you're gonna die. And then he takes the phone and just throws it off the seventh floor of a building.
Yeah.
It's completely unnecessary.
And you're like, wait, that's evidence.
Yeah, the phone being the killer, the Lily Sobieski's phone that she was using to contact the guy on death row.
Yeah.
A piece of evidence. But he just takes it and throws it off the balcony.
Here's what I think of you, phone.
I hope you can hear it landing.
Yeah, and the other, before we move on, and I want to, the other weird thing about this movie is
it's obsession with pulleys?
I was going to say this strange, like, pro-evidence tampering stance it takes. Because it turns out that, you know, yes, Al Pacino tampered with the evidence to get a conviction.
That's in the alternate ending.
No, but they say that in the actual movie.
He makes his confession, but I feel like that's under duress, you don't know.
Well, all right. I think that they're making it clear that he...
Or he coached a witness, at least.
That he did at least something unethical to push this through. And we see that the killer is actually the killer. But then, like, the movie is, like, making this justification, like, that's all right. As long as we're sure that the killer's the killer, we don't have to deal with the criminal justice system. And I'm like, wait, but the criminal justice system is there because we cannot be sure of these things.
Nope. As long as we got Jack Graham watching out for us. The movie opens, by the way, we should have mentioned this, in the year 1997. And they really recreate true. The world of – as someone who lived through 1997,
yeah.
This is how I remember it
well.
Which is a newspaper with the headline, Princess Diana Dies.
And a close-up on the date, 1997.
Close-up on the date. One of the characters says to the other, who would want to kill Princess Di? And then they go to sleep, and one character's radio starts playing, quit playing games with my heart, with my heart, with my heart. And it was like, wow, we really are in 1997, aren't we? And then it goes 9 years later, and you know we're in 2006, I guess.
But... And it was really important that they really set the time. Like, remember 1997 when all those serial killers were running around?
Well, that's another thing that's great about it is, like, why 9 years later? Really doesn't matter. Could have been 3 years.
Yeah. You can ask a lot of questions. It's just like that way.
That two-year
why
gap in
88 minutes?
88 minutes. So, Dan, are we going to do our ratings? Or?
Yeah, sure. Stuart's not here, but...
I feel confident he would say it was a bad, bad movie.
Yeah. Is this a good, bad movie, a bad, bad movie, or a movie that you liked in some way? I'm going to say the first 10 minutes and the last 10 minutes were, like, great, crazy, bad movie. But, man, there's so much just boring stuff in between. I was really encouraged by the very beginning of this movie, which was just...
Which is balls to the wall crazy.
Yeah.
It starts... You're introduced to two characters who are sisters who live together. All you know twin sisters. All you know about them is they're sad that Princess Diana died. Suddenly, a killer arrives. There's a shot where someone turns around and the camera zooms towards their face as they see the killer. Then it cuts to a cat. Then it cuts to the other character. The exact same thing. Turns around, camera zooms towards their face, and then as they see the killer, and then cuts back to the cat again.
Yeah. They've each been strung up in close succession in the exact same sequence of shots.
What's weird, though, is like the killer's MO is that he hangs people up by pulleys and then he cuts them very slowly with what looks like a tiny pizza slicer. But it's like, so you're having to believe that he drugs them, then he takes a while drilling holes in the ceiling, screwing in the pulley, Then he's got to run the rope through it. He's got to test the weight of the pulley to make sure it's going to hold.
Right.
Maybe he has got to put some anchors in just to make sure. Structural integrity of the ceiling has to be done right. Then he ties them up to the pulley. Then he's got to pull them up into the air, and then he's got to set it so it holds that they're still in the air.
It's going to be a counterweight of some kind. You know,
it's a very elaborate system.
Speaking of MOs of the killer, this reminds me, the reason that it's 88 minutes, by the way, is that the killer of Al Pacino's sister said to Al Pacino, as he left after killing the sister, "It took me 88 minutes," referring to the amount of time it took him to just dismember her. First of all, what a weird thing to say as he leaves. Like, by the way, I thought you wanted to know, 88 minutes, that's how long
it took. I think he thought Al Pacino was the guy he asked to come by from Guinness for the record of...
Well, but that's the other thing I was going to say. If it takes you 88 minutes to dismember a 12-year-old, you're just a lazy killer.
Or very weak. He might have had very weak arm strength.
Yeah.
Or he was using like a nail file.
So what were you going to say? Ignore my cat trying to knock over a lamp behind you.
I just keep worrying it's the pulley Seattle Slayer killer. I was going to say it's a bad, bad movie. I'd say it's very poorly made, and I was sorry that Alicia Witt was in it, because I think she's usually very likable.
She's cute as can be.
The only thing that that made it for me was Lily Sobieski's crazy accent, which is vaguely Eastern European or Dutch or Irish at times.
Yeah, someone write in and tell us what that accent is.
Tell us where she's from, because we could easily discover that information.
Yeah, but we're lazy. We like people.
So this is the Flophouse Lily Sobieski Where's she from contest.
Rather than finding the information out immediately by using Google or maybe Wikipedia, we would rather wait, you know, 2 or 3 weeks.
Listening, Lily Sobieski, warum kommst du? If I remember my college German correctly, where are you from? Where do you come from, to be specific?
But let's leave her accent behind.
I don't know if I can.
Tack a course bravely to the future.
I'm really worried now that I'm going to have a dream where Al Pacino accuses me of pulling his semen out of one woman and putting it into another woman. It's an obvious frame-up.
Oh, man, everyone has that dream, though. It's like being naked at school or a test. A semen Pacino dream.
Or like a dream where like you need to go to the bathroom, but you can't find a private place to go.
Yeah. Or nuclear war. That's a dream I get a lot. Do you get the nuclear war dream?
No, I think I think about it so much in my waking hours that my brain is tired of it by the time I go to sleep.
Yeah.
I used to have a dream very regularly that I was being chased by Lee Van Cleef from for a few dollars more, and just like chased through time. Like we would start out in the Old West and run straight through into the present.
Wow.
And then when we got to the present, someone would stop him and be like, "Let him go," and then I'd just leave.
This is like a great 1970s TV show that you never had the chance to make.
Time Chaser?
Yeah.
There is a movie called Time Chaser, though. But
starring Cleef. that's what they call them.
Just Cleef.
Just Cleef.
I don't think anybody ever called him that, ever.
I did. Just now.
Oh, okay. Well, touche.
Point to McCoy. Anyway, we should go on and make our movie recommendations, which will be a lot shorter now that Stuart's not here. Now that we've dismembered Stuart in 88 minutes.
88 minutes, that's all it took.
Why don't you recommend something?
Well, what am I going to recommend? I just this past Monday saw Synecdoche, New York, Charlie Kaufman's directorial debut in feature-length film, I guess. And it's gotten kind of mixed reviews, I guess. People are not happy with, I don't know, it's a movie where like you either like it or you don't like it, but it's so much Charlie Kaufman's, I assume, like his personal vision on film of what he wanted the movie to be, that you admire it. I enjoyed it a lot, even though it's a really rough movie to sit through at times. Like it's a very, you know, serious, bleak movie, but there's some really funny parts. It is like 88 minutes, a movie that feels longer than it actually is and takes a little too long, but I enjoyed it a lot. I thought it was very good. I read one of my least favorite explanations for a movie on the IMDb message boards. It's a movie that kind of skips forward through time very erratically.
The IMDb message boards for people who are too stupid to watch movies.
But there's – did you see it, Dan, or no?
No, I haven't seen it.
I don't want to say too much. Then there's a lot of like surreal moments in it, things that aren't super logical but make sense on a thematic or emotional level, because it's, you know, it's a Charlie Kaufman movie and it's a movie. What are you going to do? And I read one of the explanations online was, obviously, Philip Seymour Hoffman's character is in a coma starting from this point in the movie. Everything after that is just his imagination in the coma, and replies that were like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, now I get it. It's like, okay, well, you just took this kind of singular artistic vision and turned it into a bad, you know, yeah, like...
It was all a dream.
Yeah, or like a bad psychoanalysis, where it's like... It's like if someone watched 8½... Like, it feels like Charlie Kaufman's 8½ to a little, to a certain extent. Like, if you watched 8½, and you were like, huh, I guess he's just... If someone hit him on the head, and he's just remembering his life out of order. That makes sense.
Yeah.
It reminded me... I saw...
Well, I also love... This happens, actually, on the IMDb message boards a lot, I feel, where someone puts out an explanation that has no real support in the text of the film.
Yeah.
And then if people call them on it, they're like, well, everyone has their own opinion. And I'm like, no, that's not, but you have to work with the materials yeah. that are given.
You can't just make things up.
It's not like I watch, you know, like the Philadelphia Story, and I'm like, these are actually Earthlings who have been put in a zoo on Mars.
A space zoo, yeah.
They're working out there. The reason why there's such competition for this one woman is because there are so few women on the planet.
But it reminded me of, I was a big fan of Memento when it came out, and I remember freshman year of college, there was like a thing like, get together and watch Memento, and just a couple people showed up, and was like, oh, this is a good way to meet people. And I went and we watched it, and it's, you know, and everyone was like, oh man, I'm kind of having trouble figuring out the plot of this thing. That was confusing, which is, people have said the same thing about Synecdoche, New York, but it's like, if you pay attention to it, you will understand what's going on in it. It's not nonsense. But people were like, I don't understand. And this one girl goes, here's the way I figured a movie out. None of the things he remembers actually happened. He's just a serial killer who's convinced himself that he's tracking down his wife's killer, and that's why he's killing all these people. And I was like, well, you just took a kind of, well, like, interestingly done examination of what memory is and the nature of identity and the past and turned it into a very shitty serial killer movie.
But as a college get-to-know-you sort of event, it was a success because you're like, I don't want to be friends with this like, girl.
That's true. I got to know them, and I decided I didn't want to have anything more to do with them.
To hell with you, jerks.
Lisa, everyone knows Memento is basically just a serious version of Dana Carvey's hit film Blank Slate anyway. So,
yeah. Oh, man. Christopher Nolan, what a rip-off artist.
What a rip-off artist.
Carvey was the auteur.
Plus, he made that movie Batman Begins. It was a total rip-off of Batman. Am I the only one who noticed this? I don't understand.
He just added a little beginning to it.
And then he made that movie, The Dark Knight. It's just a ripoff of Batman Begins. Way to copy yourself, Nolan. How many movies have you made? 5, 6? Already copying yourself? Whatever.
So I would like
to recommend... movie Insomnia? Total ripoff of the book Insomnia.
Total ripoff of the Swedish film Insomnia.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, it's based on a Swedish film. I was about to base it on the Stephen King book Insomnia, which has nothing in common with either movie Insomnia.
Yeah.
Anyway, but you were going to recommend something.
Yeah, I was. If you're looking for a bad film, which people often are if they're listening to the Flophouse, and you know, usually we recommend good movies during this point of the show, but
88 minutes has broken your soul.
Well, I mean, there's a difference, obviously, or else we wouldn't have a rating system, between a bad movie that you have no interest in seeing and a bad movie that is a thing of beauty and a joy forever. And Winter Beast is a great bad movie. I watched it on the day after Halloween with some friends who were visiting from out of town. And I had it because I knew it was this horror movie that had a reputation. It was released to DVD in 91, or I guess the release date, at least in general, is 91 on like IMDb and on the Netflix sleeve. But the film, every shot in it looks like it was like a 1960s, 1970s Yellowstone tourist postcard. And it really has that feel. There are all these like knickknacks in it. The set dressers like wasn't thinking, oh, this is going to distract from the actual action of the film. It's like, I wonder if I can work a wooden Indian into this. Or like
director was Frank Oz.
A velvet painting of a buffalo. And it has a bunch of stop motion in it. Like, and I love old like stop motion monster effects. And
Level stop motion is this? Is this Ray Harryhausen level or like Equinox level?
I haven't seen Equinox, but it's...
Oh.
It's really not Ray Harryhausen
level.
Well,
then like Ray Harryhausen level or like Phil Tippett level? Or more like Willis O'Brien level? How many stop motion animators can I name? Let's see.
I watched the making of, and the guy who did the stop motion actually did some stuff for like Liquid Television. So,
oh, okay. So is it like Henry Selick level, or anyway, you were saying?
He knows what he's doing, but it's still a terrible movie. And the funny thing is, like, there are these sequences where there's like a fun monster effect, and you're like, okay, this movie showed some like imagination and creativity. And then in between, it's just bad movie dreck, like Manos the Hands of Fate level of inept filmmaking and padding and just hilarious dialogue. And so if you're looking for a bad movie that won't disappoint you, as 88 Minutes did for both of us,
certainly,
I would recommend Winter Beast.
Mr. Magorium better be good in a bad way.
I'd like to note for the audience that Elliot is currently putting his shoes on. He can't wait to get out of here so much.
Listen, 88 Minutes has tainted this for me.
He's putting his shoes back on as we are still on the air.
I'm tired, okay?
That's
fine. I had to stay up late at work last night. And then I had to go to a party with the cast of 30 Rock, and I didn't get to talk to any of them.
Jesus.
We're
lording your glamorous life over me, Caleb.
Man, the Comedy Central party. 30 Rock was there. Gina Gershon was there. I saw her in person. Who else was there? I apparently got there too late to meet Padma from Top Chef. Or Padma from Star Wars. Who else was there?
I'm over here desperately seeking my brain to think of something that might be impressive to say, and I have nothing.
No, I'm sure. Well, you said you had an open house for grad students today at your office. What was that all like?
I'm going to punch you as soon as we get off the air, so there's no proof.
Maybe I'll edit this part out. Nah, I'll just leave it in.
Well, anyway, in the absence of Stuart.
Yeah, where is Stuart anyway?
He is in, I believe, Hotlanta, Georgia, teaching people how to paint toy soldiers or something like that.
I don't really know what he does.
He trains people. They send him all over to train people, which to me is hilarious because I know that he's actually good at his job. But
they gave him an award.
Yeah, but all I can think of when I think of Stuart is him shambling into the apartment with like a tall boy of Coors Light.
And then changing into a tiny bathing suit.
Yeah, in the middle of the flop house, just emerging from the bathroom in a Speedo. We miss you, Stuart, I guess is what we're trying to say.
Is he wearing his formal Scorpion belt buckle belt?
I think so, yeah.
What a great guy. Like, this is
let's
not as
fun
without
him. Right
him.
Now.
No, let's go home instead. But it is. But hopefully he'll be here next time.
Yeah.
For Mr. Magorium. We're not even going to do that next time, probably.
I think we're going to do 27 dresses.
Awesome. You know what? Let's just do a string of movies with numbers in the title. 88 Minutes, 27 Dresses, 30 Miles to Graceland. What else is there? Come on, we can name some more. Too Fast, Too Furious.
Seven Voyages of Sinbad. That's
no,
a good movie.
It's a movie with good effects in it.
Like Winter Beast.
Go on, 30 Days of Night. I'm thinking of so many good movies with numbers in the titles. You got nothing.
21, that movie about blackjack.
Actually, yeah, that would be a pretty good one for this. Because they took a true story, made everyone in it much more attractive.
And much less Asian. The actual guy was like an Asian American, and they're like, nah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
This is a Hollywood film. Caucasian all the way.
Caucasian is kind
now,
of like Asian.
Now after Barack Obama's president, that's all going to change.
Well,
people.
This is, my friend Matt Pack has a joke in his stand-up routine where it says, the people who hate Barack Obama the most are movie producers, because now how are they going to let you know that a movie is taking place in the future? used to be the shorthand for that was black president,
yeah.
But now we're at that point. That was the thing.
Chris Rock's head of state is no longer funny.
Oh, yeah, because before it was hilarious.
Well, for other reasons, it's not funny.
But that's what's so great is, like, people are always like, where's my flying cars? We're supposed to be in the future. We've got a black president coming up soon, and CNN had holograms on.
Yeah.
It's newscast the other day. We're living in the future that was promised to us. And it's not the Blade Runner bad future, where it's always rainy all the time, and what's his name from Deadwood and Newhart is aging too fast.
88 minutes. On that note, let's sign off. I'm Dan McCoy.
I'm Elliot Kalin.
I'm Sir Wellington.
Good night. I've lost my will to live. I want to do podcasts.
Buck up, Dan. We can do this. Don't let 88 minutes be the one that breaks you.
I think it's Stuart's absence.
Yeah, it kind of hurts me.
Sad.
All right.
Hello, everyone.